Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes. I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Deterrence Down Under. And today, you're stuck with just as me as the host. The other two legs of our Australian hosting triad are off at a StratCom conference this week and should be back for our next episode. That being said, we have an excellent guest for today's discussion. He's going to focus on new approaches for the U.S. to deter conflict over Taiwan. David Achmanek is a senior researcher at RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. He has a long and distinguished career that I could spend probably a whole podcast summarizing, but I think there's two critical points worth noting. First, not only is he a researcher in this area, he spent time in the Pentagon as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Force Development and also for strategy. So he's got real-world policy experience wrestling with wicked hard problems like we're going to talk about today. Secondly, David was one of my first project leaders at RAND, and he took a fresh chemical engineer who knew nothing about defense analysis, being me, and turned him into, I'd say, a decent analyst. I wouldn't say great, but decent. So again, he had real-world wrestling experience with the hard problem of turning someone who needed to learn about defense analysis into a better analyst. Just a reminder before we get started that the views of the host and our guest are their own and don't represent any institution with which they might be affiliated. So we'll start with a little bit of deterrence-related news from Australia. The first big news is 2 weeks ago, there was a joint statement released from the Australia-US Ministerial Consultations. This is a big meeting that they have every year, and it focuses on the State Department and Defense Department's areas of responsibility for the United States. Near-term approval is coming for the much-awaited ITAR reform, and that was passed shortly after the ministerial consultations. That allows licensed free trade in defense goods in a whole variety of areas. Not all, but most of all. So that should help lower the protections and enable better cooperation in defense industry and defense technology between Australia, the United States, and the UK. Secondly, the United States is going to help Australia with Australian production of guided missiles, and it's going to start by jump-starting the Guided Weapons and Explosive Ordnance Enterprise here in Australia. So that's good news. This is something that was talked about as early as 2020 here in Australia, having a sovereign guided weapons enterprise, and it sounds like this is going to really move things along. Thirdly, more force rotations for the U.S. inside Australia across domains. So more bombers, more fighters will be visiting us, more surveillance aircraft flying from bases in Australia's north. The U.S. Army will be joining with amphibious units, joining those annual Marine deployments to Darwin that happen every year where they get some practice there. And lastly, nuclear submarines will be operating from Australia's west starting in 2027 from that sub-rotational force location. But second piece of news, and just the last thing I'll talk about just briefly here, is there was a more detailed announcement signed around AUKUS Pillar 1. And AUKUS Pillar 1, just to remind everyone, has to do with the transfer of nuclear submarines to Australia. This announcement really focused on the transfer of the nuclear material. The first announcement and agreement was focused more on transfer of knowledge. And so this talks about the details of bringing the reactors and the actual submarines over. It says that Australia must first come to an agreement with the IAEA to handle the propulsion technology appropriately, such that it won't be repurposed in any way. Secondly, Australia can't ever enrich, produce, or reprocess nuclear fuel locally for naval propulsion. And thirdly, Australia must dispose of its own waste associated with these submarines. I think none of these really comes as a massive surprise, but there was a little bit of controversy raised locally about the disposing of waste here because there's already been some issues disposing this very small amount of waste produced here in a more a medical reactor or research reactor sense, because Australia doesn't possess any reactors for energy. The last bit of that AUKUS Pillar 1 announcement is that the United States and the UK reserve the right to escape the agreement with 1 year notice if there was a problem with either the submarine industrial base or with their national security. So, you know, this leaves the United States and the UK kind of holding all the cards in this situation, and Australia in a place where, you know, they want to keep their partners happy. So interesting place for Australia to be, to say the least. So leaving this and going on to Taiwan and why we have our guest here, David Akmanek. David, you know, why is Taiwan such a concern, and why have concerns grown so much over the past, say, 5 to 10 years?
So thank you for that, Carl. Taiwan, of course, is a thriving democracy. It's a source of some important goods for the information age, as we know. Some of the most advanced chips come from Taiwan, and I don't want to minimize that, but the importance of Taiwan at the strategic level goes beyond the island itself. Whether you want to call it informal or formal, declared or non-declared commitment to defend Taiwan against overt aggression by China, the United States is seen as being Taiwan's principal protector. And if the United States is viewed by its allies or its adversaries as being either unwilling or unable to effectively project power into the Western Pacific to defend its important interests, then all kinds of negative consequences will flow from that. Loss of confidence in the United States as a security guarantor, countries feeling like they had to go their own way to provide for their own protection, perhaps proliferation of nuclear weapons, but above all, of course, increased Chinese influence in an area of the world that's very important to the stability of the entire globe. So on the interest side, there should be no question that this is a highly salient issue for the United States and for the Western allies. And when I say Western allies, I mean the democracies allied with the United States. The other reason, of course, why it's such a fraught topic is because of the increasingly bellicose language and behavior by Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders over the last 5 to 10 years. Yes, the Chinese leadership has never given up its claim that Taiwan is an inherent part of mainland China. There are reasons to question the legitimacy of that claim, but in recent years, they have been acting increasingly aggressively, as everybody knows, with regard to trying to intimidate Taiwan, showing their military power, et cetera, et cetera. So those two dynamics, if you will, are coming together to create a situation of increased tension and some danger.
Yeah, exactly. And the United States has a policy, from what I understand, of strategic ambiguity around the defense of Taiwan. Maybe you could just very briefly tell us why that exists and has that changed over time?
I think it's rooted in the original move by the Nixon administration to recognize the government in Beijing as the government of China. And of course, when we did that, we agreed that there is only one China. Actually, at the time, Chiang Kai-shek, who was the leader of Taiwan, didn't object to that because he felt that his government was actually the legitimate leader of all of China. But that one China policy has kind of put us in a place where we have to be very careful about what we say and how we say it. That having been said, I am a fan of what President Biden has done over the last 2 or 3 years when asked spontaneously how the United States would react if China overtly attacked Taiwan. He said without hesitation, we will defend Taiwan. And I think for any responsible president of the United States, that is the correct answer. It's also, as you and I being students of deterrence theory, would probably agree, it's also the strategically astute answer to give. I think there is a pretty firm consensus, certainly in the policy community within the United States, that we need to posture ourselves to effectively defend Taiwan. And again, referring back to my earlier points, posture ourselves to effectively project power into the Western Pacific against any potential overt aggression that China might take against our allies or our interests or our partners.
Very good. Yeah. And what broadly, you know, if conflict would kick off over Taiwan, what would it look like for today's forces? You know, there's a number of scenarios. What do you think is the most likely and what are alternatives?
Well, the scenario that we focus on as defense analysts, you won't be surprised to learn, is an invasion of Taiwan that would consist of an amphibious attack supplemented by airborne air assault operations onto the island with the intention of overthrowing the Taiwan government and occupying the island, forcibly incorporating it into China. That's the only scenario by which the mainland can have a hope of controlling the outcome, as opposed to, say, a coercive strategy. And it's also the most stressing scenario because it imposes severe time limits on the defenders. You have to be able to bring decisive power to bear over the battle space, in the battle space, within a matter of days in order to be confident of defeating that invasion. And that scenario, not surprisingly, reveals some fairly significant gaps in our capabilities and our posture with regard to defense of Taiwan. So we learn a lot from those war games and from those scenarios, and those lessons are beginning to be reflected in our defense investments.
Yeah, I think you mentioned one of the challenges that exists for today's forces, which is just timeliness and being there in time, because the home team always has an advantage in these situations. The value of proximity is quite great. What other challenges would exist for U.S. forces or allied forces or a whole alliance attempting to defend Taiwan?
Yeah, let me not skip over that responsiveness piece, though. People need to be reminded that since the end of the Cold War, when U.S. forces have been sent to fight large-scale conflicts, the bulk of the force that we take to those conflicts comes from somewhere else. The first instance being, of course, the Gulf War of 1991. It took 5 months to build the so-called Iron Mountain on the Arabian Peninsula before General Schwarzkopf and the Allies were prepared to kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait. We have to be prepared to bring decisive combat power to bear within 5 days or less. So we need to first abandon this belief, implicit belief, that you can use an essentially expeditionary posture to credibly defend Taiwan itself. And that's going to result in that is going to have to result in some very significant changes in how our forces are based, how we think about prepositioning assets, the whole approach we take to projecting power, at least in that part of the world.
Yeah, but doesn't that also lead to the challenge of China's issue with, you know, ballistic missiles and their threat from that? We've got a threat from ballistic missiles. They can attack, you know, nearby basing. How do we get around that dual challenge of having to be there quickly, yet being at risk if we are there close to surprise attack?
Exactly right. It's a dilemma. So the textbook solution of putting more airplanes at bases within range of China, basing more ships in Yokosuka and elsewhere, even in the Marianas and in Australia, you are within reach of Chinese precision guided weapons. And yes, we can do a certain amount of a hardening of our bases. We can deploy active defenses like THAAD and Patriot. But at the end of the day, we know in this world that offense beats defense. So the future posture has to be characterized increasingly by deception and by mobility. So if we're going to be pre-positioning assets in the theater, we need to hide them in plain sight, in anonymous warehouses, in places like Japan, the Guam cluster, Australia, in shipping containers, of which there are millions scattered throughout the Western Pacific. But also we need to untie ourselves from dependence on fixed facilities. And this is particularly important for the Air Force. Today, the Air Force has no air vehicles that can operate without a runway, at least other than very small UAVs used for surveillance purposes. That has to change. And our analysis is pointing to opportunities to launch and recover airplanes from mobile teams operating in the field, and if you posture yourself that way, you are creating for your adversary the problem we had in Iraq called the Scud Hunt. You will recall that the Allies spent weeks searching for mobile ballistic missile launchers in the Iraqi desert after we had gained complete air superiority over that part of the battle space, and we almost completely failed. We need to give that problem to our adversary, China.
Exactly. Yeah, so we've talked about some technologies to get around timeliness and being there and having presence. What are some of the other challenges in this invasion? I would imagine, you know, sinking, you know, surface vessels might be an interesting one. What kind of challenges are there, and what new technologies have you been looking at there?
Sure, yeah. So I mentioned that the invasion, the bulk of the force will come by sea, supplemented by airborne air assault from paratroops and helicopters. So order of magnitude, we ought to be thinking about posturing ourselves to sink or disable on the order of several hundred ships within 24 to 48 hours, several hundred helicopters and cargo aircraft, again, within 48 to 72 hours, and do all this in an environment where the adversary actually has air superiority, not something that an American force has ever had to actually contend with. Typically, our, again, implicit operational concept is the opening phase of the war is devoted to gaining dominance in key domains, maritime domain, air domain, information domain, probably the space domain. When our blue teams in war games try to do that against China, they fail. The defenses they have in place are too dense, too modern, too capable to do that. So we have to find ways to reach into that contested environment from the opening hours of hostility, do sensing and targeting, even when we don't have air superiority, overwhelm local air defenses with lethality, and attack the things that are the center of gravity of their invasion. We're finding ways to do that. But the force that can do it looks quite different than the force we have today.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I've studied quite a bit of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and this is a yes. conflict where neither side has been able to gain air superiority. And, you know, there's a series of raids and overwhelming of the air defenses where right. you throw a lot of potentially cheap assets in the air and force the enemy to think about engaging those to help get your expensive or more capable assets through the system. So yeah, thinking in new ways is definitely the way here, I think.
Exactly right. And all that stuff needs to be pre-positioned in theater well prior to the outbreak of hostilities. Having it in Oklahoma doesn't help you when you've got days to prepare yourself for defending something halfway across the world.
Yeah, exactly. And in terms of allies, so thinking about, you know, say Australia or Japan, what capability could allies contribute in this kind of fight to help augment U.S. capabilities and Taiwanese capabilities?
So one could have a virtually limitless wish list of things we'd like our allies to be able to bring to the fight. But if we start at the core and build outward, the core, of course, is assurance that U.S. forces can deploy to and operate from bases and areas within their territory. This is particularly important in the case of Japan. The U.S.-Australia relationship is such that we have, and you can correct me if this is wrong, we have confidence that our ally, Australia, is going to be supportive of us taking actions from Australian territory as necessary to defeat the invasion.
I'll comment on that real quick. So the Australian government, confirms its sovereign right to make a decision about that. Yet at the same time, Australia has joined the United States in every major combat operation since World War II. So let's assume Australia will join.
Yeah, and we don't take anything for granted. We absolutely respect that. And but the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty does not obligate Japan to support U.S. military operations that are not directly defending Japan. Now, the Japanese government increasingly has said publicly and in its own strategy papers that it regards the rise of Chinese military power and belligerency as a threat to Japan's vital interests. And it's been, I think, increasingly recognized in Japan that the government of Japan cannot stand idly by and watch China commit blatant aggression in its region. But ensuring that we get a rapid decision to permit U.S. combat operations from Japanese territory will be an important part of a combined defense, and we'll look to that. Other important contributions would include allowing U.S. forces to, in fact, disperse outside of base areas so that mobile platforms can have survivability. Continuing to invest in things like ballistic missile defense, anti-submarine warfare, maritime interdiction capabilities. As you can imagine, all those things are very valuable in the context of defending Taiwan. Also, our Marines and Army are in discussions with the government in Tokyo about putting long-range missile forces in the southern Japanese islands to, again, allow them to range into the Taiwan Strait onto Taiwan itself. To the extent that we can deploy those capabilities there and convey to the leadership in China that our allies will allow us to use them promptly, will be a tremendous enhancement to deterrence.
Yeah, and so I think a lot about nuclear things as part of this podcast. And do you think there's any potential that a Taiwan conflict could go nuclear?
You can't rule it out. Obviously there would be two very heavily armed nuclear powers fighting each other. We do see in our war games a recognition on both sides that it is in both China's interest and America's interest to keep the war limited. Now, it may seem funny to apply the word limited to a fight between the United States and China. I don't mean that there would not be serious losses. I mean, we're talking hundreds of ships, hundreds of airplanes, tens of thousands of soldiers, sailors, and airmen whose lives would be at stake here. But it is difficult to see how it would be in the interest of either side for this conflict to expand much beyond the geographic area of the battle space around Taiwan, much less expand vertically to the use of weapons of mass destruction. And I will just say, in my experience in war games, we have not seen that escalatory dynamic play itself out.
That's good. And in terms of preemption, this would be another concern for allies, preemptive strikes against allied territories before, striking U.S. territory or, U.S. forces on U.S. bases. Would that be a concern, and how can the United States help extend deterrence in a conventional way to prevent against those, strikes?
Yeah. So, obviously the best deterrent to strike is the ability to thwart that strike. I would love to be able to say that we can deploy and sell enough missile defenses to comprehensively protect our allies against even large-scale missile strikes. That is not actually technically feasible or affordable. As we mentioned earlier, offense dominates defense here. So while things like THAAD, Patriot, short-range air defenses, aircraft to shoot down cruise missiles can protect against modest-sized salvos of incoming missiles, they can't guarantee that that large attacks wouldn't create significant damage on bases within, say, 2,000 or more miles of the Chinese mainland. So the other deterrent is to confront China with a combined defensive capability. And by that I mean the ability to defeat an invasion of Taiwan that is sufficiently credible to convince the Chinese leadership that they don't want to do this at all. It's very difficult to foresee China striking Australia, Japan, Philippines, absent some larger ongoing conflict. And if they lack confidence that they can achieve their goal of forcibly seizing Taiwan, then I think the threat of aggression against our allies goes down significantly.
Yeah, exactly. And this is an important piece, is communicating, you know, will and capability. And I think this is one of the big challenges with new technologies like AI, like drone swarms and other things that aren't quite proven in combat and are difficult to prove in a test environment that they will work in large scale combat. How do you communicate that capability? And not really a question, just a point for everyone to ponder, which is how do we demonstrate that new capability will make a difference and increase deterrence? It's a real challenge in this world.
It is. We can go out to the test ranges and evaluate the performance of UAVs and sensors and communication links and all that. But in the presence of an adaptive enemy with countermeasures, and when you're talking about a combat environment in which you'd be scaling up the applications of these things by maybe two orders of magnitude, it's hard to gain certainty about how things will perform. That said, I want to confront China with the reality of these kinds of capabilities on their doorstep. I'd like them to wake up one morning and see 200 UAVs in the Strait of Taiwan, looking at every fishing boat, cargo vessel that's going there, and sending that information back to Taiwan, back to Hawaii, to our operation centers.
Yeah, so turning those Chinese incursions into the Taiwanese ADIZ on their head, and you know, doing Taiwanese incursions into the, you know, the ADIZ, you know, and monitoring Chinese activities.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily advise going across the center line of the strait. But you can make your point by putting this mesh up there and forcing them to understand. So the information domain is of primary importance to the People's Liberation Army. We know from reading their doctrine that they think that the centerpiece of modern warfare is to dominate the information domain. If they lack confidence that they can let me not put a double negative. If they believe that we can enforce a sensing grid on that contested battle space that they can't neutralize, that cuts right to the core of their strategy. And I want to show that to them. Again, we don't have the forces in place today to allow us to do that, yeah, but we need to get there quickly.
Fantastic, fantastic. So if I give you the budget pen and say, yep, you know, come up with a force that looks different from today's force, how would it look different, and what would your priorities be?
So just order of magnitude, I'd like to see 10,000 small UAVs in shipping containers, warehouses, caves on Taiwan that both Taiwan forces and U.S. forces on island can employ to impose a sensing grid on the strait. I'd like to see order of magnitude 1,000 larger UAVs that could be launched by mobile teams and carry two air-to-air missiles or one anti-ship missile into that battle space. And if they survive that sortie, come home with a parachute and land, and I'm going to turn you around and send you back into the fight. I'd like to see serious numbers of large diameter unmanned underwater vehicles deployed into Yokosuka with a certain percentage of them at sea all the time. And they could carry shorter range weapons into the battle space as well as sensors. The whole replicator initiative is consistent with this vision. And I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing there. I'd just like to push the accelerator down, I think, a little faster to get these things fielded quickly.
Yeah, a lot different than, you know, today's capability. A lot of unmanned capability, a lot of technology that needs to go into that in terms of either AI or human monitoring of these things.
Yes.
Or human over the loop monitoring of these things.
Yeah, there needs to be some autonomy, and it all, again, needs to be forward based prior to the rise of tensions or hostilities.
Yeah, I think that forward basing is key, because the minute you start to forward base, you're shadowing a conflict. You know, if you haven't done it in advance, if you're trying to deploy into theater, you start to signal that this is about to kick off from our point of view.
Yeah, and China gets to determine when to start the war. I don't want to leave the initiative with them. I want them to know that it's in their face 24/7, 365.
Exactly. Well, fantastic. I think that's all we have time for today, even though we could have continued this conversation another half hour or 60 minutes even. I especially want to thank our guest, David Achmanek. It's been a great discussion around the potential for great power competition to evolve into conflict over Taiwan. Those who want to learn more about this should read the excellent 2023 RAND report titled Inflection Point that David authored along with other RAND colleagues. Are there other pieces that people should look at from RAND that you've done recently?
Oh, I have some. So RAND, as you know, Carl, we have a tendency to write books. Books are a little daunting for busy people, particularly in policy positions. I have some shorter unclassified pieces that I could share with you, and you could maybe put on your website for people to look at that are more user-friendly, get at the same kinds of questions.
Fantastic. Hey, thanks again, David. Really appreciate it. And thanks for everyone for listening. And remember to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.